Successful people learn how to make their mind work for them. I'm David Nagel, and this is the Successful Mind Podcast.
That a person's life can change in an ordinary instant. I think it's something that we really need to consider. A person can die. A person can walk out of our life in a divorce. A business can change. A business partner can change. A friendship can change. Relationships with our parents, with our children, our own relationship with ourselves, our physical health can change, our finances can change. Life is an interesting thing. And the idea that it can change in an instant, I find very striking because with that change that actually takes place with an individual or in a person's life or however that looks in a person's life, very often we don't consider that it can change that fast. And not only can things change for the good that fast, but I don't necessarily think that when something changes for the good that fast that we sit and question it with the same kind of depth as when something changes that we would consider negative or that we don't want to really happen. There's a really great book by... I think her name is Joan or Joanne Didion, was written in 2004, 2005. And it's called The Year of Magical Thinking. And I've read this book a few times. I found out about it a number of years ago. And again, I recently picked it up and went through it a bit. And she kind of starts off the book with the idea that life can change in an instant. And she's a very accomplished writer. And she's written about a number of things throughout her career. And the book is really, it kind of tracks an entire year of what she went through when her husband died of a sudden heart attack right in front of her. And what that was like to go through that change. And I've heard many people say it's a magical book. And in a lot of ways, it is a magical book. And I think that for any person that's going through grief, although she does say in the book that she considers the grief of a death that a person goes through and what happens with them is a little bit different than the grief of, say, a divorce or various other things. I'm not so sure I 100% agree on that. Although I've never had a spouse die. However, I've gone through grief myself, and I recognize a lot of the things that she went through in the year after her husband's death. But here's what I want to talk about when it comes to this. Like, how do we deal with this? How do we deal with life changing in an instant? In her case, was sitting down to dinner with her husband and he just keeled over with a heart attack and literally dropped dead. And it takes her the better part of a year to come to terms with when actually did he die? Meaning that, she dialed 911 or whatever she called in, and the paramedics came and they worked on him and then they took him to the hospital. And there was the death report of the time that he died officially. They gave an official time to the death. And through her research and study over a period of time, she realized that he was actually basically dead by the time he hit the floor and fell out of the chair. He didn't die like an hour and 15 minutes later or whatever the time frame was, but it was a pretty significant amount of time from the time he actually fell out of the chair with a heart attack until they said what the time of death was. Now, you might think to yourself, why am I saying this? What's important about this? What's important was the obsessive nature of the way that she thought about these things and everything that she did with her life, with her husband. They were married for 40 years, so it's a very significant relationship. And from what I can tell, based on the book, it was a very good relationship. They had their ups and downs, but it was a very good relationship. While this happened, they had a daughter that was in the hospital in a coma, I believe. She was suffering from some kind of an illness or something. And she's going through this process of grief and how her mind accepts it and rejects it and all the different things that she does with this. And as I was going through this book again, I was looking at it from the prospect of what do we believe is the truth? Because this idea about what is true and what's a lie is on my mind a lot lately. I find myself getting a bit agitated internally as we're watching the news, as we're seeing different events unfold politically and from worldview and through the difficulty that we're going through with sexual ideas and race ideas, left and right ideas, socioeconomic ideas. Like, there's so much turmoil in our world today, and it's almost like we can't get away from it. You can't turn something on television or open your computer or read your phone and not have somebody's point of view like thrust in your face around all of these issues. Now, why am I getting agitated by it? Part of the reason that I get agitated by it a bit, and when I say agitated, let me be more clear. Let me be clear about what my experience is with this. My experience with this is the length of time in which we choose to kind of suffer with these problems. And I think that I have this belief that we're not dealing with the truth of these issues on a level of this idea. In order for us to be suffering and fighting each other about all of these issues, which are they're real issues. I don't want to take anything away from that. They're real issues. There needs to be something about it that is making it more complex than it actually is. And that's one of the things that I keep hearing about the world's issues. It doesn't matter what it is. That the more we discuss it, the more that we seem to be working on it, the more that we debate it, the more that we argue over it, the more that we suffer from it, there's an underlying feeling of complication. Like these things become so deeply complicated. And I was thinking, what is it that complicates these things so much? So I'm going back through the book again, A Year of Magical Thinking, and I'm watching her describe how her brain is basically fighting her with the reality of her husband's death. So she's going over how they would have coffee together, or when they would be in New York, how they would walk down the street and go to a special restaurant and have chicken Alfredo together, or what dishes they would use if they were in their California home, or what the sunset looked like as they were flying over Monaco, or, you know, the watching as they're flying into Italy or flying out of Italy, and they can see the Alps or something. Like, there's all these different particular things that you can see. She's really struggling with 40 years of memories around her husband. And then as she starts to go through her life without him, she realizes he's not there, but almost everything that she does in her life is causing her for a memory to become up, to be triggered in some way that this memory then comes back up for her, and how she actually is dealing with it, and the struggle. And so what is the problem with this? The problem is that her brain is fighting the reality that her husband is dead, that he's gone, that he's not coming back, that he literally died the moment that he fell out of the chair. There is no what could happen, what should happen. If the situation was different, it could have turned out different. And throughout the year, she has to come to terms with the fact that it wasn't anybody's fault. No matter what other circumstance could have been created in that situation, had they known that he was going to have this massive heart attack at this point in time, nothing could have stopped it. And then the point comes to the surface that we're all going to die. Like, there is a day coming for each one of us where our life will change in an instant by the death of another individual or by ourselves. Although we probably won't know it when it's our own, but we definitely will experience it when it happens with other people in our life. So it's not just, another thing that was striking was that it's not just her missing her husband or the love that she had for her husband, but it's also how the brain is very much attached experientially to everything that happened with her husband. And it doesn't like on a physiological level and a mental level and an emotional level, it does not want to let go of those experiences. And it takes time for the brain to let go of those experiences. New experiences have to start to come in and replace the old experiences. Now, one of the things that I think is interesting about this is the idea that our brain is always comparing, even when we don't realize it's doing this, actually, it is always comparing the experience that we're having right now to an experience that we had in the past. I'm here in our podcast studio. Brandon's in here with me. He currently is listening to me create this lesson, or so to speak. He's taking notes so that he can ask me questions to do inside the episode, which we'll do probably 5 minutes after we're done shooting this one. And if something had changed in this room that was different than it was a few days ago when I was in here recording, my mind would probably pick it up very, very quickly and say that that's different. But it's not anything really of any striking importance, so there would be no emotional attachment to it. There probably wouldn't be a whole lot of judgment around it. It wouldn't emotionally impact me in any significant way. But the truth of the matter is that there's so many things in life that actually do, that change in an instant, and it emotionally impacts us in a very large way. So what is it that is causing this consistent, it's almost a psychosis in a way, and I think here's one of the reasons why. So the brain is comparatively judging, if you will, or evaluating the way things are now versus the way things were. When you're emotionally attached to a person, that's a very big deal. And the brain is constantly under the direct impact of the idea that something that was so significant in our life is no longer there. It's gone. It's not coming back. So it's not coming back. Yet the brain is very resistant to accepting this. It's not the person. And I know that because I've gone through this, I've watched other people go through this. This is actually a physiological thing that's happening in the brain. These are changes that are happening in the brain. The brain is resisting accepting the truth. So I start thinking, if we're so resistant, if the brain is so resistant about accepting the truth with things that are consistent changes for human beings forever, like death, we even see this with animals. Some animals operate the same way, but in miniature comparison to humans, time frame wise, when they die. Elephants, you see, will experience grief. Dolphins will experience grief. There's other animals that also experience, I can't tell you all they are because they haven't done the research on it, or the length of time, but I know that generally it's considerably shorter than human beings do. But there's an adaptation that has to take place before they accept that one of their kind has died and where they're able to move on from it. With human beings, what's very interesting is that we don't always move on from it. And in many cases, something will happen to us in a way where we come to this conclusion that we can't live with this change. And in many cases, this is very well documented. Some people actually die a short period of time after a spouse dies. The language I want to say is they can't accept it, but I'm not so sure that would be correct. Because I also think that we're fighting the way that our brain is operating at the same time. It becomes very, very attached to things, and especially people and relationships. Now, if we look at it, if we pull the camera out and we give ourselves a bigger world view, and we look at the way that the world is really, really struggling right now with so many different problems that we can't seem to find the solutions to. Even though there's many people that feel they have the solution, part of the problem is that, let's take racism, for instance. Let's just take that one problem, racism. And you have people who are racist, and then you have the people that are victims of the racism. And they each have their own perspective of how they view not just the other person, but the idea of what they believe about that person in the totality of that idea. So meaning all the different meanings that they give to what they don't like about somebody else. And here is a truth that we're dealing with racism, and it's also with every other problem that we're having. We don't want the problem to exist. We want the problem to not be there. So this is a factual thing, and I encourage anybody that's watching this to argue this point with me. Like, I'm telling you to argue this. Show me something different. Give me a reason to think something different here. But if you, in my opinion, as I look at this, we want the problem not to exist. Now you think about all the different problems, right? We have problems all over the world in so many different areas, and they're all very, very serious issues, right? We don't want the idea of sexism to exist. We don't want the idea of abuse to exist. We don't want rape to exist. We don't want racism to exist. We don't want murder to exist. We don't want starvation to exist. We don't want chemicals in our food to exist. We don't want corruptive power to exist. We don't want corruptive people to exist. We don't want terrorism to exist. We don't want war to exist. We don't want divorce to exist. We don't want abortion to exist. And I could probably go on here for a couple of hours of all the things that we don't want cancer to exist. But they do. These things do exist. And with a lot of the problems that we have, especially when it comes to we need somebody else to change in order for the problem to go away, my question is this. I'm trying to formulate this correctly because it's quite an interesting path to go down. Why do we continue to suffer with these problems? Now, the simple solution is because racist people are racist or, you know, whatever. People do bad things. That answer's too simple. But then the moment that I say that, we go into complicating it. We go into confusing it with things. We go into millions of different opinions that people have around all of the issues that we have. And here's something that I know. One of the things that I know is that whenever a human being is in a state of confusion, somewhere in the processing of what they're confused about exists a lie. a lie exists, a non-truth. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not factual evidence to be backed up by whatever the person's evaluating, whatever their experience is, whatever may have happened to them or happened to others. Of course, there's factual evidence. And I think one of the biggest problems that we have is that we take this factual evidence and we make that factual evidence the truth by which we try to solve the problem, and then it becomes part of the problem. Because within the factual evidence, it's not necessarily true just because it's a fact. And here's what I mean by that. If we all believe in a lie, we will behave, we will act, we will plan, we will evaluate, we will adjust, we will attack, we will victimize, we will be victims of that lie. Why? Because we believe it. And that becomes a very big problem. Now, you can look at large evidence around this, things that are simple today that we know, but they weren't at one time. Like when everybody on the planet thought the Earth was flat. Well, if everybody believed that the Earth was flat, it would really limit exploration by the idea that we all believe this. And people would think that they would either fall off or sail off, you know, the end of the world or the end of the Earth at some point, because it had an edge for us to fall off of. And if everybody believed it, the behavior would stay the same. It doesn't mean it's true. The factual evidence that we would be using for that experience would probably be our eyesight, and thinking that the horizon would be the line, as you know, as far as we could see, and then that would be the edge. No matter how far you walk into a horizon, there's always an edge. The edge never goes away. So then that becomes the factual evidence. But the factual evidence is actually a lie. It's not an edge. It is just, it is number one, the distance and how far we can actually see. And from a ground perspective, from a ground level perspective, our eyes can't see the curvature of the Earth. So there's facts that present information to our brain, and then without having any other knowledge, we accept that is truth. And of course, then we come to this belief that was around for a long time that the Earth is flat. So the question I want to present to everybody out there is, what is it about the problems that we have today that are not true, that are keeping us in confusion, that have us looking at just factual evidence, but arguing the evidence as if it was true? And because we argue the evidence as if it's true, it doesn't actually, we can't get to an answer as to how to eliminate the problem, because we have the evidence and we're using the evidence as the entire territory for the problem. So it doesn't ever go away. And the perception on all sides is dealing with the same factual evidence from their perception, by the way, to argue that their point of view is correct. We've seen examples of this. You could take, so just for instance, like I can hold this cup up to the camera, and I could say there's writing on this cup, but from your point of view, there's no writing on the cup. And without any other knowledge, your point of view is correct for you. That is a fact. However, it's not the truth, because if I turn the cup around, now you have a different point of view. There is writing on the cup. There's a picture on the cup. There's a word on the cup. But now I'm seeing your point of view, which is there's no writing on the cup. So it doesn't make both of us right. It doesn't make both of us true. All it says is that we have factual evidence from the standpoint of our understanding in the moment. And that keeps us very much stuck in the idea of what it is that we're perceiving is actually being being the truth. I think that with a lot of these problems that we've been dealing with for a very, very long period of time, that we are not actually either willing or knowledgeable enough to sit back and consider that there may be a truth that we're not accepting. Maybe we don't want to accept it. Maybe our brain is fighting to accept it. And it keeps us stuck in the way that we try to make sense of the problems that we actually have in the world today. And that if we were to sit down and really look at what is the truth behind these problems, let go of our factual evidence for a moment to consider there may be a truth that we're not seeing, that we would solve the problems, that we would actually have a way to get to the solutions that we're looking for. I also want to say that there may be some reason that we need to consider that our brains don't want to let go of the experience in order for us to see the truth. Here is one of the ways that our brains do this. So when I coach people on their business, when I coach people on how to make more money, when I coach people on how to do extraordinary things in their life, one of the things that I work with them on is helping them determine what are the lies that they were raised with that keep them experiencing the same experiences over and over in their life? What are those lies? And then help them replace them with the truth so that they can literally change the experiences that they're having, and they can do it in a very short period of time. And then that experience for them is something that's permanent because they're no longer living their life by a lie. So In our company, one of the ways that we do that is we help people make, you know, 7-8 figures a year and more. We have an extraordinary track record of doing that. And without one exception, in 20 years of working with individuals, the people that I work with had beliefs and experiences that basically told them that those things were not possible for them or their business. They knew that it existed. They knew that other people could do it. They've watched other people do it. They knew that there were systems and strategies that would allow them to do it. But there was something about their own personality and the way that they were raised. And I'm not going to get into all the different untruths about it, but there were a lot of untruths that are accepted to keep a person in this box. And we see it with relationships, and we see it with health, and we see it with business, and we see it with money. We see it with success. We see it with a person going after their dream, whether they're realizing their dream or they're failing at their dream. In order to get to the side of these things that we want to experience, we have to accept a truth that we're not aware of in the moment, so that we stop thinking, planning, negotiating, creating, reacting to the lies that we've been told all of our life. So, what do we do with this? That's a really good question. I don't, as of the recording of this podcast, I don't have an answer for each one of these problems, but it's something that I'm going to start working on, because there's many things that I study and work with that I don't really share with individuals, because it's in a formation of ignorance in the moment, meaning that I'm working on things, and until I get them worked out, I'm not prepared to put a stake in the ground and say, here's what I believe, or here's what the truth is. Many of the world's problems that we're facing right now, I'm considering very deeply in my mind and working on it diligently to determine what is the truth and how can we get to a place where we can accept these things, where our brain is no longer actually resisting it, so that we can actually drop the problems that are holding us back in the world and actually all move forward. I will give you one that I think is very important that will change the lives of everybody that's listening to this. If we live by the factual evidence that we're victims, you will adjust your life from the point of view of a victim. If you decide that you're not going to live by the factual evidence of that you're a victim, and you come from the truth that you're creating your life, you come from a place of shifting responsibility onto yourself. Now, I know when I say this, because I've been around many, many people, and I've talked to thousands of people in lots of different rooms and seminars and such, where when you say that, you can instantly see the energy in the room begin to shift. You have the people that they, damn it, no matter what, they're going to stick to the idea that they were victimized in some way. That can be true, right? That can be factual evidence that you were victimized in some way. But if we were to have the courage to say, I was victimized versus I'm a victim, I think we can make a significant shift in the outcome and the way that we deal with whatever the victimization actually is. Being victimized and being a victim are two very, very different things. If we understand that, we can make a radical shift in the experience that we have in our life. In the book, A Year of Magical Thinking, she comes to the conclusion that she's not a victim of her husband's death, and that she was not victimized by her husband's death. But she comes to the understanding that it's inevitable. And the truth is, we're all going to die, and we're all going to know someone who dies. And through the acceptance of what is versus the resistance of the way we wish things were, we can make a significant change in our life. That's one of the amazing things about that book. And I think that that's one of the amazing things that can actually happen with our world right now if we come to the realization that we're not victims. We can make a big change. Because here's one of the things that we all pretty much know. It doesn't matter what side of the problem you exist on. What I see is that everybody wants someone else or some idea to change. And when we do that, we have to be very careful that we're not putting ourselves in a victimization position to do it. Because the only way that most of these changes actually occur is that if everybody agrees that that idea needs to change. But what is the lie that keeps us in the idea? I suggest the lie is fear. Fear keeps us in a place of not accepting and wanting and wishing things to be different. We call that magical thinking. And I think that's why she wrote the book, A Year of Magical Thinking, because she was fighting the idea of the way that she wished it could be versus the way that it actually is. And if we can accept things the way that they actually are in truth, not just in the reality of what we experience, we could all make a significant shift. So what is the common belief that is underlying almost everything that causes us to stay in very, very dysfunctional problems? It's fear. That's the lie. Fear is the one thing that I've seen as a commonality that runs through all of it. And when we come from a point of fear on either side, we can't get to the truth, because what we're doing is we're negotiating the fear. So that's something to think about. I promise I'll do more on this at some point, but I wanted to put that thought out there. And again, feel free to argue it with me. Give me your point of view. There's no judgment here. I'm just looking to get to the truth, and I hope everybody else is also. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Successful Mind Podcast. And if you like what you heard and you want to know more, go to davidnagel.com/freestuff.